from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Gareth Higgins, author of How Not to Be Afraid, Seven Ways to Live When Everything Seems Terrifying, published by Broadleaf Books. Born in Belfast in 1975, Gareth Higgins grew up during the Northern Ireland Troubles and now lives in the U.S. He writes and speaks about the power of storytelling to shape our lives and world, peace and making justice, and how to take life seriously without believing your own propaganda. He has been involved in peace building and violence reduction in Northern Ireland and helping address the legacy of conflict, received a PhD in sociology from Queen's University Belfast, and helped teach the world's first graduate course in reconciliation studies at Trinity College Dublin. He also helped found The Wild Goose, New Story, and Movies and Meaning Festivals. Gareth Higgins leads retreats in North America and Ireland, and he founded The Porch magazine. How Not to Be Afraid opens with this sentence. As I was finishing the final draft of this book, you and I were living in the midst of crises. I thought that was an interesting way to open, and I asked him to talk about opening in conversation with the reader mid-crises. We begin with his answer. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I was in the midst of crises too, and I meant that it wasn't just a kind of a language trick or a gimmick to real people. And I'm subject to all the challenges that any of us are subject to. I have some privileges, I have some lacks, but the pandemic happened to me as well. The rise of authoritarian populism happened to me as well. The climate crisis is happening to me. And I'm not an expert on overcoming fear. I'm not sure anybody is. I don't think there's much benefit to people pretending that they are something they're not. There are limited exceptions. Mm-hmm. I think the movie Life is Beautiful, in which Roberto Benigni plays a father who turns the experience of being in a concentration camp into a game for the sake of his child, to keep his child safe. That's a really good example of when pretending to be something you're not actually does serve the common good. And you could probably argue that he's not pretending to be something he's not. He's actually being fully who he really is in that moment. But you know, I've seen books and teachers who seem to present the notion that they have it sewn up, that fear isn't a problem anymore, that they're spiritual giants. I've also seen, and I don't buy that. It's just not true, you know. And if it is true in very, very limited circumstances, there's not much I can learn from somebody who's got like a magic gift, because I don't have that magic gift. What I wanted to do was to meet people where they are at. And if you're not experiencing fear, if you're not experiencing the crises, then the book's probably not for you, you know, or it might be there to help you help other people. But I wanted to start from a place of saying, the difference between me and many readers might be simply, I've had the opportunity to think about these things a lot and to write a book about them, and then to take responsibility for writing a book. Not that the book is perfect, or that, it's certainly not that it has no flaws, but I wanted to do something serious that could be helpful to people without sugarcoating our reality. And the other issue the other challenge I see with a lot of writing and teaching about the bigger things in life. Mm-hmm. The first is the one that I've mentioned, where sometimes people can portray themselves as they have this magic gift that really isn't available to anybody else, or they're deceiving themselves about what spiritual growth looks like. The other is when there are kind of the self-help cultures which only help the self and don't help anybody else and don't have an outward focus. And there's a long, well-worn path of narcissist narcissism dressed up as spiritual growth, and there's a long, well-worn path of ideologically purist activism that's about being an activist 24/7 at all costs and then wiping yourself out, exhausting yourself. I wanted to step into a third way, which is concerned for the world and the needs of the world, but also recognizes that the teaching from the tradition that I come from is not love your neighbor instead of yourself. It's not do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but set aside any of your desires to have anybody ever be kind to you or be kind to yourself. You know, like, it would be better to be thinking in terms of do unto others as you would want to do for yourself. Never mind what you'd want other people to do for you. Do unto others what as you would want to do for you if you truly loved yourself. And people who truly love themselves aren't egotists or narcissists. They can't help but love the world. Mm-hmm. They can't help but ache for the pain of the world. They can't help but give some portion of their life to serving the needs of others. The healthiest people are able to do both, love themselves, take time for themselves, tend to their own souls, ask for help in the areas where they have need, but also be willing to sacrifice to serve needs in the world, especially those who are more vulnerable. So I suppose I started the book from the place of I'm not above anybody reading this, mm-hmm. but I'm not below anybody reading it either. We're all in this together. Let's see what we can discover.
That seems like a nice segue into something that the book talks about that I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about now, which is, I think you refer to it as healthy true fear versus unhealthy false fear. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I think one of the first things I discovered when I started reading about fear, you know, I've been thinking about fear all my life because I've felt a lot of fear for most of my life. That when I started reading about it and looking at neuroscience and psychology and the deeper, more credible spiritual teachings, is that fear is an evolutionary inevitability, and it's actually necessary in its healthiest forms. It's what keeps us from not putting on a seatbelt and driving in a fast car. It's what keeps us from walking too close to the edge of a cliff, unlocking the door of the cage of a lion and walking in and hanging out with the lion without adequate preparation. That's the purpose of fear, is to keep us safe. And so when in the ancient scriptural text says the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, the context I grew up in manifested that teaching as like the terror of God, the wrath of God. You better be terrified of God.
Right.
I don't think it means that. I actually think it just means respect for reality is the beginning of wisdom. If I walk out in front of a truck, if I consciously choose to walk out in front of a truck, that's not wisdom. You know, I have a friend who thankfully was not killed, but was hit by a truck crossing the road, and it was not her fault. You know, it was not, fault is the wrong word. It was not through her own making. And she would be the first to say, walking out in front of a truck, can't you make that decision? That's not wisdom. And we shouldn't be terrified of trucks. We should just respect them, right? So necessary fear is that kind of fear, the fear that is wise, the fear that says there are some risks in the world and you have to make a judgment and hopefully make that judgment in discernment with other wise people about what risks are worth taking, you know? Everybody has to take risks. In fact, you know, the risk of failure is a good one. You know, mm-hmm. that may be less dangerous than the risk of stepping off the edge of a cliff. And you know, it's hard to imagine a good reason to step off a cliff. You know, so that's necessary fear. That's inevitable fear. That's the fear that not only can we not do anything about the things that are the amygdala, which are these little things in our brains that kind of cause us to feel fear. And not only can we not do anything about those, we shouldn't try to suppress wise fear. The problem is our brains have not evolved quickly enough to keep up with the bombardment of information and story in our culture, particularly in the last 50 years or so of electronic media and the last 20 years of the internet and the last 10 to 15 years of social media. especially with these little devices that we hold in our hands, we keep in our pockets, which of course can be immensely helpful. They tell us how to get to places. They give us information that might be useful. They help us connect with people, and there are more connections and more multicultural connections than there have ever been, it would seem. Of course, there is a sacred golden side to the use of electronic media. There's also a really important step forward in human beings learning to take responsibility for discernment ourselves, because we no longer have the same kind of editorial gatekeepers who would decide what is the news that's worth hearing. What you get told at 10 o'clock at night, somebody like Walter Cronkite comes on with a deep voice, tells you the things you're supposed to know, and basically the country's discernment of reality depended on Walter Cronkite's integrity or mood. And Walter Cronkite worked for a big corporation that had an agenda. You know, whether it was a benign one or a malevolent one is another topic. Now we don't have those gatekeepers. What we have is algorithms. And of course, there are gatekeepers to the algorithms. And so we get access to information we might not have had before, but we're on our own. And so the algorithm then groups us with other people like us, and it perpetuates prejudices, it perpetuates fear, because electronic media is economically wedded to the notion that if it bleeds, it leads, whether it's metaphorical or literal blood. And so it wants to keep us here, you know, it wants to keep pushing us to more panic. Today's a really good example. I find myself repeatedly checking the BBC website as the deadline for nominations for who would be the next UK prime minister was approaching, you know, and then a voice in my head said, Gareth, you know, when it gets to 2 o'clock, they're going to announce. You checking it at 1:50 and 1:20 and 10:20 and 7:20 isn't going to give you any more information or change the outcome here. And that's a more mundane example. I think a more serious example is when there have been experiences in the last 20 years where there have been bombings of civilian areas by people who are politically motivated and have killed large numbers of people. And what would tend to happen would be two things. One would be there'd be a huge uptick in anti-Islamic sentiment that would immediately be triggered. Bigotry coming from a place of fear, you know, and then ordinary Muslims would suffer as a result of that. There'd be no meaningful exploration of what had actually happened, why it happened, who did it, how could we prevent this happening again. On the other hand, you'd have people who didn't go in for the anti-Islamic sentiment, but they would feel the terror that is triggered inside us when we hear about horrifying things. First thing we do when we hear about horrifying things is we ask ourselves, am I safe? You know, if I know I'm not there where it's happening, then I have a degree of safety and I might feel some relief. The wise thing then to do would be to ask, is there anything I can do with the resources that I hold to help the people who are in that situation right now?
Right.
And the truth is, if I'm not there, there's probably not much I can do. I could pray, I could send light, I might be able to send some money to relief efforts whenever, you know, people are trying to put themselves back together. But if I could invent an egotistical story, a narcissistic story that says I'm some kind of messiah figure that can help in this situation that might be thousands of miles away, rather than what's staring me in the face, which is I may well have Muslim neighbors who need some reassurance right now that I understand the difference between someone who engages in terrorism and someone who doesn't, and that has nothing to do with religion or ethnicity. Having grown up in the north of Ireland, it's very clear to me that one of the ways you could look at the dividing lines between people in the north of Ireland is not support for a united Ireland or support for the United Kingdom, but support for the use of violence and opposition to the use of violence. And that goes right down the middle of our society, Protestant, Catholic, pro-British, pro-Irish. And you don't divide people then to condemn them. It's just simply as a matter of discernment to then, once you analyze the problem proportionately, you can start to come up with approaches to responding to the problem. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a long way of saying our brains haven't evolved quickly enough to keep up with the bombardment of story. And electronic media has a deep shadow side of provoking our amygdala to stay alert all the time. And that makes us afraid. And when we act out of panic rather than wisdom-based fear, we make poor decisions. Mm-hmm. We hurt other people. We become aggressive. We see a shadow when we think it's a burglar, but it's actually our child having a nightmare mm-hmm. trying to come into the bedroom at night. And there have been tragic stories of parents who've killed their own children because they were primed to think someone would burglarize their house. And actually, it was just their own child mm-hmm. asking for help.
Yeah. Okay. I have two. May I read two quotes?
Of course, yeah.
All right. These are close together in the book. One is this. There are good reasons that my psyche latched onto the idea that something awful was going to happen to me. I was formed in a place where awful things always seem to be happening, so much so that the story of our place seemed to be that awful things were the only things happening, or at least the most likely. So that's one. The other is, not being able to talk honestly with others makes it easy to develop an overactive voice in your own head. And some of this you just addressed, but I wanted to talk a little bit about, you write a little bit about what I would call self-sabotage as far as making ourselves more frightened than we need to be, working away from that healthy fear into the kind of more dark fear that is hopefully unnecessary. Do you want to maybe talk just a tiny bit more about that and about, you know, how people can avoid doing that to themselves?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure you can avoid it happening, but you can learn to respond to it. I just think it's we live in a culture where this is all around us. Mm-hmm. Our brains are, because of this necessary wisdom fear, I like the idea of distinguishing wisdom fear and panic fear, you know, or paranoid fear. The wisdom fear is a gift. It saves our lives all the time, every day. It saves our lives. And it's become second. Most of the time you don't think about it, you know. A therapist said to me once, you know, the most dangerous thing that you're going to do today is something you've already done by getting into a car and driving to this therapy appointment, you know, or the most risky thing. So these things will arise in our minds. And the way to transform them is really, really, really simple. The bad news is it takes an entire lifetime to master it. And it's probably not going to be the thing if either of us get to live to a ripe old age and get to know that we're going to die and be on a deathbed and have, you know, some people seem to be fortunate enough, they get to make a speech at their deathbed. You know, most of us are not on our deathbeds going to say, "Wow, I'm really glad I just realized last night that I finally conquered fear." You know, no, I did have a therapist who died from an illness, and so he knew he was going to die. And at his funeral, his spouse spoke, and I talk about this in the book, and said that his last words to her were, "I want you to do whatever you need to do and whatever you want to do, because you have your journey and I have mine." And then his last words were, "Let's just not panic."
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so
Walter, was his name Walter?
No, that was another mentor. That was Yola.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So the way we transform this, first of all, you know, bad news is you're never going to complete this journey. And that's actually good news, because it gives you something to live for. Growth is something to live for. You know, it's one of the reasons why I imagine the notion of an afterlife where everything is perfect all the time and there's no change that's not utopian to me. That would be exceedingly boring. And there has to be an opportunity for change and growth. The good news is the path is simple. And the doorway into the path is even simpler than the path itself. And for me, the doorway is this: learn to breathe more slowly and develop relationships with three or four or five other people who are committed to the same path, and learn to ask each other questions that will call forth deeper wisdom than you know you already have. Those are two variations on practices that are available the world over in many different faith traditions, in many different psychological schools. You don't have to be a specialist. You don't have to be a religious believer. You don't have to have an academic qualification to do this. You just need a place to sit and a willingness to breathe a little more slowly. And there's plenty of breathing practices available. I write about one of them in the book, which is just slowing down your breathing by about 10%, not forcing it, but slowing it down so that you're taking long inhales and long exhales. And as you inhale, call to mind something that reminds you of gratitude, compassion, or love. It could be anything. It could be a fictional character that makes you smile when you think of them. It can be a face of a loved one. It can be a place that you remember well. It can be an event in your past that calls to mind gratitude, compassion, or love as you breathe in. And each time you inhale, let the image of that thought get stronger and clearer in your mind. When I'm doing this, I'm often thinking about a drive-in movie theater screen in the desert with a mountain behind it. And each time I inhale, the image being projected on the screen gets clearer and brighter. I'm looking at this thing that reminds me of gratitude, compassion, or love. And then when you really have it, when it's really clear and bright and crisp, the next time you exhale, send that image to every cell of your body, to your toes, to your fingertips, to your nose, to your ears, to your chest, every part of your body. And then do it again. Breathe in again, let the image be clear and crisp, and then send it to every cell of your body. And you can do this in a minute. And there's people who do this for 14 hours at a time. You know, there's people in monasteries in the Himalayas who are doing this right now, and they've been doing it for weeks, and they've been doing it for you. I mean, that's one of the things that I take great comfort from, that there are people in all kinds of traditions around the world who have understood their calling in life to be people who meditate, pray, and love people that they will never meet. There are people meditating and praying for us right now. They maybe don't know our names, but they're praying for people in the United States who are burdened with a divided society, mm-hmm. who are feeling fear about whether or not the pandemic is going to get worse again. There are people who that's their job in life. They've laid hold of that calling, and we can participate in that too in this really simple breathing practice. That's the breath part. And then the community part is to gather two other people, start with a group of three, because two people is a conversation, but three is a community, and ask four really simple questions. The first is, what's something that's life-giving to you right now? And limit it to one thing and don't talk for more than a minute. Something that's life-giving. I'm looking out at the moment at seeing fall leaves in Western North Carolina, which are world-renowned. I'm so glad I got back here to North Carolina right in the middle of the peak season of the leaves. That's life-giving to me. Or a conversation I had with my friend before this call, or this call itself, this conversation itself, being able to be in conversation about interesting, valuable things and to learn from each other. That's a life-giving thing. The second question is, what's something that's not life-giving? And the trick is to describe the thing, but not to feel it. Mm-hmm. Because often you can say to somebody, what's wrong? And they'll go into a litany of what's wrong, and they'll end up feeling worse. You know, and really good therapists, really good spiritual directors, really good coaches, really good friends help people talk about the thing without falling into the burden of the thing again. And so I might describe something that's not life-giving. And it could be as simple as, I'm very busy at the moment, and I'm finding myself stretched too many ways. And then, you know, you can get into, all right, what's this trying to teach me, or what can I do about this? And sometimes all I can do about it is sit in the ashes and lament with my friends and right. experience the reassurance of solidarity. The third question is, and this is where I think we start to transcend the narcissistic version of the self-help movement. And that is, what new story do you feel called to live between now and when we next meet that serves the common good, right? And again, it's not a messiah complex, not about saving the world. It's simply ask yourself, say we're meeting weekly in this group of three, what is likely to happen to me between now and the next time we meet where I will have an opportunity to live from a better story, a story of wisdom, a story of love, a story of compassion, a story of truly doing unto others as I would want to do for myself. And then limit it to one example. So for me, it is almost always the next time I go to a grocery store, I want to have eye contact with the person serving me at the checkout, and I want to talk to them in a friendly way, right? And that doesn't mean that's the only kind thing I plan to do in the next week. It's just if I can do that, if I can do that, it might kickstart the rest of my what James Taylor calls is a beautiful James Taylor song. I think the song is called Look Up From Your Life. And, you know, look up from your own navel gazing and look at somebody else's humanity in need and offer them something kind. And there's something, it's a sociological reality. It also seems to be a metaphysical reality that kindness done authentically for others always reflects back to you in some way, maybe not from the person themselves, but something happens that's ineffable that makes your life better when you are kind and courageous to others. And then the last question we ask is, having heard what we've heard, is there anybody here who wants to offer some help to somebody else in the circle? Or is there anybody here who wants to ask for some help from someone in the circle? And it can be as simple as, I need a babysitter. It can be as profound as, my best friend died suddenly last week and I really need comfort in my grief. Or it can be as existential as, I'm having a theological crisis and I don't know if I believe in anything anymore. Could someone go for a walk with me every Saturday for the rest of my life? To which our answer would be, let's try the next two Saturdays and see how we get on after two Saturdays. We need to be giving each other, as a culture and a society, we need to be giving each other bite-sized opportunities to be beloved community. We set ourselves too high a bar when we say, I'm going to spend the next 50 years doing this one thing that's going to change everything. Let's do two Saturdays and see where we're at after those two Saturdays. So those are the two simple ways, I think, onto the path of transforming fear. Breathe more slowly and be in community with people who are asking the right questions. There are other ways to do it. And like I say, it's the working out of those steps is a lifelong journey. But you might find if you practice that breathing thing for a minute a day, that you want to practice it for 2 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. Or 5 minutes a day, or that it becomes something that you just find that you're doing without even noticing that you're doing it. And over time, your very body is changing. Mm-hmm. The way the blood flows in your body is going to change. The oxygenation of the blood is going to have a relationship with how you feel. And it isn't that scary things aren't going to happen anymore. It's just that they're not going to be the most important things, or the fear that you feel about them might not be the only thing you feel. You might see a scary thing as an opportunity to love someone. You know, that's often what happens when a truly scary thing takes place. I know it's become a cliche that I think Mr. Rogers was quoted as saying, look for the helpers. You know, whenever a catastrophe happens, there's always people who run toward the fire. This is true. This is true. Terrifying things call forth love. You know, it'd be great if we could get rid of terrifying things altogether, but we won't. The question is, how can we live in a world which tells us that terrifying things are the story of our lives? That's not true. The fall leaves are part of the story of our lives. This conversation is part of the story of our lives. The fact that we have technology enables us to do that. And usually the people who are suffering the most and those who lack the kind of privilege that you and I have, they tend to be, certainly the people I've met, tend to complain about it less than people of privilege, right?
Yeah.
And so the task of having privilege, and the resources of privilege, is to discern how to use those resources to serve people who don't have those resources.
Yeah.
And to not be blind to the truth that just because you got some money or a roof over your head or ease in your life, that doesn't mean you don't have needs. You may actually have some pretty profound, deep needs for community or meaning and purpose because your life has insulated you from having to actually do anything meaningful. Yeah. And that's its own burden too.
Yeah. I think what I'm going to go to next is, you have this great idea about the fact that we are all living a story in progress. Hmm. And I loved that. And it reminded me of something I was going to share with you, which you may have heard before because I think it's sometimes out there. But Sam Shepard had a line about endings. Have you heard about this?
No.
He wrote, I think this was in a Paris Review interview. The temptation towards resolution, towards wrapping up the package, seems to me a terrible trap. Why not be more honest with the moment? The most authentic endings are the ones which are already revolving towards another beginning. And I loved that, sort of taken in tandem with, we are all living a story in progress. And I think you sort of said something about, like, don't look at it like this is going to end. It's going to keep going.
You know, I often think about, for the sake of the dignity of this person, they're a public figure. There was an actor who won an Oscar, and a really beloved actor, and a week later their marriage broke up, and their spouse was, exposed by, I think, the National Enquirer or something, to have had multiple extramarital affairs. And I've often thought about this actor. She's wonderful, she's beloved, and how at one level she had like the best week of her life, and it was maybe also the worst week of her life. That she did win that Oscar even after her marriage had broken up. She still had the Oscar. And even while her marriage was, you know what I mean? Like that two things are always happening. At least two things are always happening at once. Two things are always happening. There's always a burden. There's always a bit of light in there. Right. If you read, there's an amazing, amazing book. I believe it's called I Never Saw Another Butterfly. And it's a record of written and drawn artifact from a concentration camp in the Second World War, where an art teacher, actually it may not have been a camp itself, one of the, they called them the Jewish ghettos, where people were, effectively trapped. And an art teacher had gathered up some art supplies and brought them with her when they were being deported into this prison, as it were, so that she could do art with children. And I Never Saw Another Butterfly is a book of what came out of that, what was available. And there's a piece that, for people listening, I'd recommend you Google the Nashville singer-songwriter Julie Lee, L-E-E, who has a song on her first album called Stones. I hope this is available online, that she put to music a poem that a child in this environment had written, right? And this is an environment that is truly unimaginable. I'm not even sure it's imaginable to people who were there, I'm not even sure it's imaginable and describable to people who were there. But this poem by someone whose life was potentially going to be snatched away from them at any moment, living in this, amidst some of the worst things human beings have ever done to each other. This poem is about, he doesn't know the world at all, who stays in his room and doesn't go out, and goes on to describe the experience of being out in the woods and sitting on the ground and looking at the trees. And if you'll really look at the trees, you'll know what it is to be alive. Now, that's not me talking. That's not me trying to stand in the place of someone who was suffering in this way. That's them. Right. That's someone. They have the right to speak for themselves. They have the right to say, as Anne Frank said, even in the midst of this terror, I will still love. I will still cherish. In fact, the terror pushes me to love what is lovable and to cherish what is cherishable. And that speaks of how the foundational fear is the fear of death, or the fear that death is the worst thing that's going to happen to you. I do not believe that anymore. I believe that the worst thing that could happen to you is to not live while you're alive. That the thing to be afraid of is not that we will die, but to fear the unlived life, to fear living somebody else's life, even if it was a fabulously successful life with all the trappings and bling you could imagine. If it wasn't your life to live, you would be empty inside. You would be empty inside, and I'm not there, right? I'm 47, so maybe I'm in the middle of my life. Maybe I'm a day away from the end of my life. I don't know. What I want is to continue to be led by people who have glimpsed and claimed that there is more to life than the fear of death, and there is more to meaning than success. Another of my teachers says, if you see, I get this is a paraphrase, if the out of control train is careening toward you and is going to hit you, if you form the judgment that you can't jump out of the way, right?
Right.
Certainly, if you can jump out of the way, you should. You should jump out of the way. And if there's someone else with you, you should grab them and help them get out of the way and help as many people get out of the way as possible. But if you can't, wouldn't it be wonderful, knowing all else being equal, that you're not going to be able to avoid being hit by this train? If you can't jump out of the way and if you can't rescue anybody else, wouldn't it be wonderful to greet that moment by looking at the train and saying, thank you, how can I be of service? Right. And I know, and you're right to laugh, because it is, at some level, it's ridiculous.
There's an absurdity, but
there is an absurdity to it. But there's also an absurdity to a train careening out of control. And with all respect to people who have died and suffered in such circumstances, there's almost no analogy we could use that wouldn't be painful to somebody. You know, I use the analogy of not walking too close to the edge of a cliff. 29 years ago, a dear friend of mine was killed in a cliff fall. And it wasn't because he was stupid. You know, it wasn't because he was being cavalier. It was because there was an unexpected gust of very heavy wind. You know, it's just a tragedy. Yeah. So there's almost nothing we could use as an analogy that wouldn't be hurtful to somebody.
Right.
But whatever, if the train is like a metaphor for death, wherever you are in relation to your death, however far off it might be, wouldn't it be better to live with the sense of death is an opportunity for gratitude, because it teaches me what matters and what doesn't? Mm-hmm. Does it really matter if I have a best-selling book or not? Does it really matter if everybody likes me? Does it really matter if everything I want doesn't always get achieved immediately? There is a vision in all the sacred wisdom traditions and in lots of the social justice traditions of a world in which everyone, I love this way of putting it, everyone gets to live underneath their own fig tree in peace and unafraid. I'm under my fig tree, you're under yours, and we're looking at each other and waving. And every now and again, I say, Shayla, you want to come over and have some figs? And you could say, yeah, you'll be glad to know I just turned my fig tree into an olive tree, so we don't have to be eating figs all the time. And I'd be like, great, bring your olives. I want to learn about olives. I don't have to have a monopoly on the crop that the tree is going to produce. And that vision is absolutely worth living for. But it's not a vision that says, I have 7,000 fig trees and you have none. You know, that 7,000 fig trees are going to make me happy. You know, the only way that having 7,000 fig trees is going to make me happy is if I know how to treat them better than other people, that they're under attack from other people, and I'm going to share the figs with everybody.
I want to ask you a question about writing and fear and ego. All fear and ego are things that come up a lot in your book, How Not to Be Afraid. And it made me think about authors, writers. I think oftentimes writers have to have a certain amount of ego in order to put forth words that they think other people might want to read. But there's also a lot of insecurity and fear in writers about whether or not they can achieve what they would hope to achieve. And I'm not talking about fame and I'm not talking about money. I'm just talking about the things that drive us toward putting our thoughts on paper. Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts on that, about specific for writers?
Yeah, whether or not it's ego, there's a drive to do any kind of work that's supposed to be seen by others, whatever kind of art or politics or writing,
us talking right now.
Exactly. So there is a drive to that. And, you know, for a lot, you know, obviously it certainly has an overlap with ego. The important thing is to be aware of it and to not let it stop you from doing good and meaningful work, and to recognize that it's kind of narcissistic and egotistical to say my ego is so big that I really shouldn't write. You know, I am like, I have the biggest curse, and therefore I'm so important that I'm going to withhold my genius work from the world. So there's a balance here, but I'm a work in progress. And also, that's what good editors are for. Good editors will help. And I had a marvelous editor, Valerie Weaver Zurcher, for this book, and in the early drafts, Tyler McCabe, who's a friend of mine, who wrote to me once and said, I'd like to edit your book, not for money, not for credit, but just for the sheer humanitarian thrill of it. And that's great. If you can find that part, the sheer humanitarian thrill. So you don't want to repress that drive so much that it ends up stopping you from writing. But you do want to share, if you want your writing to be seen by other people, to be read by strangers, it's really good to ask people who know something about writing to take a look at it and consider the possibility that any pushback they might give you might not just be a personal attack because they haven't understood your sacred genius to the world. It might be because they're trying to help the best of you come out. No, you have to weigh it up. Sometimes an editor and a writer aren't the best fit. They're not the best match for each other. I got lucky this time around. I think there's also a tendency of writers, especially writers who's just getting started, to think they have to write everything they know because they think they're only going to write one book. And so everything they've ever thought has to be in this one book. And there's also, so that can be helped by a good editor. There's a tendency also whenever publishers will ask for what are the competing works, which I hate that phrase because we shouldn't be in competition with each other. But as you know, what they mean by that is what are the other similar books out there? And a tendency I had in the past was go, well, there are none. You know, this is such a unique book. There couldn't possibly be any competing works. And the publisher would then say, well, then I can't publish it because I don't know how to market it. Right. I need to be able to say this book is like that book, or I need to be able to take to my higher ups and say this one could do well because that one did well. Now the question is whether or not the publisher is actually going to market the book at all. That's a conversation for another day too. It seems to be there's something still hasn't been fully joined up for. There's a lot of writers who feel a deep sense of something didn't. The manifestation of the book in the world is often not supported to the degree that the writer wanted or expected. Right. And I think that's partly because the publishing industry is going through this totally unprecedented shift. I've been reading Thomas Merton's Letters, which is a magnificent book. And one of the things that's unique about it compared with his other writing is the letters, as far as I know, they weren't censored in the way that his publications after he went into the monastery had to go through a vetting process by people in the order. But these are just letters between friends. And it's really interesting when he's talking about the challenges about being published. This is Thomas Merton, you know, one of the leading writers in the country in the 50s and 60s, one of the most influential writers in the country. But he didn't have the freedom that I have. He didn't have the freedom that I have with a blog. You know, for Merton, if he wanted to publish something, he had to write it, to think about it, edit it, get it through the vetting process, get it to the publisher, and then a year later it would be published. If I want to publish something, I just type it and hit return. So, I mean, that's the amazing upside and the challenges.
It can be downside too, depending on who you are and what you're writing.
That's right. If you're not thinking clearly and not referring it to some accountability to wisdom. And also, somebody like Merton was writing at a time when a tiny fraction of the number of books published today was being published, when publishers had the resources and the spirit to nurture writers. You could have 3 or 4 books that didn't sell, and a publisher would be happy to keep you because you were a good writer, and maybe the 5th one's going to sell, you know? Now it seems to be more that you can have... There's lots of writers. I was reading recently, 90% of books published in the US sell less than 2,000 copies. And so there's lots of publishers who will take on a writer who might sell 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 copies of a book. And the publisher's not disappointed by those sales. It paid for itself. And yeah, sure, I'll publish your next book. The writer is disappointed because they can't make a living out of writing when they only sell 3,000 copies. Now, similar to the music industry, I just think that's one of the shifts in the way culture is produced. Mm-hmm. And so just as musicians have had to shift their business model to make more of their living from live performance and retreats and songwriting workshops and things like that, because musicians can't make anything like the proportion of their income from album sales in the past. Mm-hmm. I think something similar is happening with a lot of writers. If you're not a best-selling writer, and I'm not a best-selling writer, you know, I've been well supported, but, you know, books that, like I say, 90% of books published in the US sell 2,000 copies or less. And my experience of best-selling writers, there's two reasons people are bestsellers. One is that they previously had a bestseller. And so then the publisher puts all the resources into publishing their next book. And the other is through some fluke of circumstance. It has very little to do with the quality of the writing. There are thousands of magnificent books that haven't sold many copies at all. There are thousands of books that are, shall we say, different to magnificent. They're not magnificent. They've been massive bestsellers. There are few books that are magnificent and also bestsellers. Sometimes the stars align and there is a confluence there. But for the most part, the quality of a book has no relationship to its sales. Mm. And so that can actually, if you can get that in your mind when you're setting out to write a book, that can help with the ego part. And you ask yourself, what's the difference between my motivation and my intention? Mm-hmm. My motivation is to write something of surpassing quality. Or write something authentic. That's my motivation. My intention is that 2,000 people will buy it. That would be wonderful. Or 500 people will buy it.
Right.
You know, or if my intention is that what I want is for people to read it, then I need to give it away for free. Mm-hmm. That's how a lot many more people will read it. And so divorcing ourselves from the need to make a full-time living from writing, I think is probably the first piece of advice I would give any writer starting out. I want your words on the page or on an ebook, and I want your voice out there, and I want it authentic and meaningful and to contribute something that only you can contribute. And I want you to let go of unrealistic expectations and recognize the possibility even that not selling lots of books might be better for your soul, might be better for the quality of your work, might give you a better life. And yeah, if it becomes a bestseller, wonderful. Great to have good stuff out there.
But in that case, make sure you get a good editor the next time, because they won't make you.
Because they won't make you.
They won't necessarily. I think there are a lot of best-selling authors whose second, third, fourth books don't get the same kind of editing because the publisher is just looking to have it go out and be a big seller again.
Or they'll publish a manuscript you wrote 20 years ago because it's just sitting around, or a book you already published. They give it a different name, and you know, and sometimes that can be wonderful. But more maybe to go back to this thing about breathing and community, to be mm-hmm. in community of your peers, of people who are trying to do good work, whether it's writing or hospice chaplaincy or food bank support. If you're trying to live from your authentic calling to serve the needs of the world, those are your peers. Mm-hmm. Those are your peers, you know, and none of us is more important than anybody else. None of us. And none of us is less important than anybody else. There's many, many things I could never write a book about. And there's many things I do better and differently to writing books, you know. What I want is for people who are writers, and that's anybody who writes. That's what a writer is someone who writes. You know, and if you don't write, you might be an aspirational writer, and start writing and you'll find out if you're a writer. whether or not you're a good writer is another question. And whether or not you're a successful writer depends on your definition of success. What I really wish for is more of a sense of interdependence among creative people, not unhealthy competition. I think there can be a healthy, I know I said earlier that I don't like competing works. I don't like competition. There can be a sort of a healthy, if it's a friendly, mutually respectful rivalry, like, oh, Shelley, your last book, it was amazing. I really loved it. Good for you. Wait till you see what I'm going to do next. And then you try to outdo me the next time. And it's, you know, friendly in that sense, like, right. or converting envy, instead of being trapped and choked and suffocated by envy, looking at the person you envy and asking yourself, what is it about them and their work that actually really attracts me, not what repels me through envy? Yes. Okay. They picked themselves up and they did this thing. They did this thing. I want to do it too, using mm-hmm. my gifts, using my calling. That's what I'm going to do. Not I'm going to sit here and just moan about the fact that somebody else got something that I don't have. So yeah, it should not be unpleasant competition. It should be there should be friendly rivalry among artists, and there should be genuine, joyful affirmation when any of us succeeds at doing something creative. Right. A friend of mine who in Belfast, a poet, wrote an extraordinary book last year, and she won a major poetry award for it earlier this year. And I wrote to her because I was just so happy for her. And I don't always feel that when friends of mine have big successes.
No, I know.
I do not always feel that. Maybe you identify with that feeling too.
I think all writers do.
I think all people do.
Yeah.
But there was something about this one that, you know, this was a fluke for me. I didn't feel envy when I heard about her award. It's partly because I have a great deal of affection for her, and partly because what she wrote about is a profound tragedy. And so it was kind of hard. Like, you write about this profound tragedy and you write about it in this deeply whole way that's a gift to the world that I think probably cost her to write. And then you get an award for it. It's not like the two things. It's the award does not balance out the pain, but she's not writing from a place of victimhood. She's writing from a place of offering something, I think, healing into the world. So I wrote to her to say, look, I'm just amazed. Well done. This is fantastic. And she wrote me back the most amazing thing. And this is what I would like every Academy Awards ceremony, every Grammy Awards ceremony, every Pulitzer ceremony, every award ceremony of every kind that's to do with creative work. I would love to hear more people give this kind of speech. She wrote me back and she said, it's bewildering. And she was indicating, I never set out to win awards. I just set out to write a meaningful book. Then she said, I'm humbled. I hope that the attention this book is getting will be a light that I can reflect back onto everybody else who is trying to do creative work in the same field as me. And that's to do with honoring the pain and the transition in the north of Ireland away from civil conflict into whatever peace looks like. She was saying, I would like to hold up a mirror, and when someone shines a light on me, I would like that light to reflect onto all the other mirrors out there too. And not that I think she would, you know, step out from behind the mirror so some of the light shines on her face. It's not that unhealthy self-deprecation, but it's both, you know. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate your kind words about my book. I find that so meaningful, and it validates to a degree what I did with it. And tell me about you and tell me about your work. Oh, and I would love more people to know about what you're doing too. Nobody loses when we treat each other that way.
Right. No, it's wonderful. I always end asking for advice for writers, and I think you've just answered it, actually. I want to just say, again, I've been speaking with Gareth Higgins. His book is How Not to Be Afraid, published by Broadleaf Books. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure, Sheila. Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Gareth Higgins, whom I actually met on a retreat. He and his husband, Brian, lead these amazing retreats in Northern Ireland. Gareth Higgins wrote How Not to Be Afraid, published by Broadleaf, in addition to other books that he's written. And I wanted to just mention he has a line on his website, storytelling, spirituality, cinema, violence, and peace. Those are the areas that Gareth writes about and speaks about. In the book, he invites readers into habits of hope rooted in Celtic spirituality and the mysteries of love. Each chapter also offers a specific invitation that can help readers learn to replace an unhelpful ritual with a life-giving one. Gareth Higgins was kind enough to allow me to share one of the invitations in his book, How Not to Be Afraid, as this week's Write the Book prompt. And also, you'll remember, during our interview, he shared the breathing exercise. That's also one of the invitations from the book. But later in the book, he invites us to name our fears. So here is that exercise, And the write the book prompt I'm going to suggest is that you do this and then write about what you're feeling afterwards. Sit still in a chair for 10 minutes or as long as it takes. Ask yourself, what is it exactly that I'm afraid of? Keep asking it until something like a satisfying answer comes. Write down or sketch your thoughts. Put another chair in front of you and visualize the thing that's frightening you. Imagine this fear as if it were a person. Describe them in detail and perhaps even give them a name. Step outside your usual pattern of relating to this fear. Imagine yourself to be their parent or teacher, perhaps even their friend. Remember, this is not an actual person, just an imaginary personification of the fear. And you're not really their parent or teacher or friend. You are just imagining what it could be like to know that you have more power than this fear does, that you are bigger than the fear. One of the Zen Buddhist koans teaches that beneath all violent anger, shame, and disconnection are fear and sadness. We rage, we humiliate or feel humiliated, and we separate because we are afraid of losing something important to us, or because we grieve the experience of having lost something in the past. Beneath this fear and sadness is deep caring for the well-being of ourselves, our loved ones, and the world, but we often haven't learned how to express that caring without causing more suffering. We rage, we humiliate, and we separate because we don't know how to love. So while thinking of the personified fear, allow yourself to imagine the wounds and fears that such a person might have experienced and that led them to be the scary presence they manifest for you. What might they fear losing or have already lost? What might they care about with which you could empathize? How might you hold healthy boundaries with them, but also love them, help them, meet them where they are lonely? Again, write down or sketch what comes to you. Keep those notes or sketches handy as you continue this journey. Those are the words of Gareth Higgins, the author of How Not to Be Afraid, and I thank him so much for letting me share that here. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. We've got about a minute left, and I don't want to sign off without saying that Gareth Higgins is actually going to be in Vermont. My guest today will be in Vermont. That's coming up, I believe, in a week, but I'm sorry I don't have all the details about that, but his website is garethhiggins.net. You'll find more information there about all kinds of stuff that he does. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. That's where you can get all the archived episodes going right back to the beginning of the show. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to access the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you like the show, please rate it where you find it. Talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.